Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 5th of September 2013 here in Japan, and today I'm joined on the line once again from the United States by Jeremy Rees of AlienScientist.com. People might remember Jeremy from an earlier conversation that we had, and you can check the archives of CorbettReport.com for that conversation. But if you'd like to know more about his work on exposing 9-9-1-1 and what actually happened on September 11th, 2001, I will direct you to a YouTube channel, youtube.com/warcrime911. Where there are a number of different documentary videos that go into great degree of detail about the names, places, events, and connections behind the events of 9/11. Jeremy Rees, it's great to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you, James.
Well, Jeremy, as we stand here on the threshold of yet another 9/11 anniversary, it strikes me that the 9/11 truth movement has become frustratingly stuck in a type of spin cycle where the same few facts and the same few talking points seem to be regurgitated ad nauseum by the 9/11 truth community, seemingly with the vast majority of people out there who advocate 9/11 truth not understanding just how far the research into these names and dates and connections has come in the last few years through the work of people like yourself, people like Kevin Ryan, of course, investigating and recent releasing a book, Another 19, talking about the legitimate 9/11 subjects, people like Mark Gaffney and others uncovering the financial aspects of 9/11. So I want to get into some of these details with you today to really try to expand the scope of this 9/11 discussion and hopefully get a few more talking points into the mix here and perhaps expand people's understanding of what really happened that day. And it's an exceptionally large subject and one that you've covered very well in several videos that you've posted online. So I will direct people to them and I will post some links to them in the show notes for this interview. But let's start by talking about an interesting piece of this puzzle that I hadn't even come across until I saw it in your video, which was the Project Hammer and the treasuries were used to fund black operations in the lead up to 9/11. Perhaps you can tell us more about that financial aspect of this crime.
Right. That was covered in the E.P. Heidner article called Collateral Damage, and people can look that up if they want to read it more in depth into where I got that information from. It was actually a lot of that was covered in Mark Gaffney's book, Black 9/11, where he talked a lot about what sort of financial motives might there be for people to destroy the World Trade Center, say, or for insiders or people inside. And, you know, a lot of us have looked at different suspects over the years that have come up, and names like Larry Silverstein often ring a bell to a lot of people within the movement. But people don't understand we've gone a lot further than that and looked in and found quite a bit more names. And one of the places we started looking, which I never thought to look originally or had no idea how to even begin looking there, but found my way there through the work of Kevin Ryan in his article, who had demolition access to the World Trade Centers. And he actually looked at who were the tenants, the Wall Street and real big financial tenants inside the World Trade Centers prior to 9/11. And it struck me, wow, you know, like who would have thought, you know, if it really is this big of a deal. I mean, the physics alone is what convinced me, being a physicist and seeing the towers come down. I knew that they had to have been demolished with explosives in a controlled demolition. But to think who could have done that and for what reasons is a very was my next question. And part of my research for the last 8 years has been trying to determine and answer that very question. And it really helps if you start looking at the actual inside of these buildings and who was in there. And this Project Hammer thing is a very interesting thing because it relates a lot of the same players back to things from like the Iran-Contra scandal and a lot of these other previous covert operations undertaken by a lot of the elite forces that we see popping up in similar operations. And it's interesting, this Project Hammer thing. It definitely needs to be a lot more thoroughly investigated. I think if people want to find more good information on that, listen to, read up on, Mike Rupert. He actually went to Russia to debrief several of Russia's top economists on, the collapse of the Soviet Union shortly, around that same time. And he has an excellent article where he goes over a lot of the detailed information about that, about what could have been Project Hammer, the economic implications of that whole ordeal. And not to say that there wasn't other covert operations as well against other countries that were tied into these accounts that were being basically these large-scale hedge funds that were set up for these covert operations to be untraceable, and they need to trace where that money sort of comes from. And what's interesting, I came across the testimony of a whistleblower named Richard Andrew Grove, who actually worked inside the World Trade Center prior to 9/11. And as some people may know, he was designing this software for a company called Silverstream. And this software was being designed by the Silverstream company, and it was being sold to lots of Fortune 500 companies, including many companies with were tenants inside the World Trade Center. And these sort of trading platforms were set up. And he found a bug in that software, which basically allowed a backdoor for anyone to go in and rewrite the accounting transactions or to install some sort of malicious code. And into these financial accounting mechanisms. And so what also they found is in Convar, they were searching through some of the hard drives that were recovered from the World Trade Center, and they found a huge spike in transactions like during the attacks and shortly before the towers fell. While these attacks were occurring, billions of dollars were being routed around systems and computer systems within these within the World Trade Center while this was all going down. And I thought that was incredibly intriguing and interesting, because that aspect has never been investigated. The SEC declared a national emergency and basically destroyed all the files related to that, and said that they weren't going to look into any of these securities. So someone could have taken that advantage and moved around a ton of money while those attacks were happening, and then had it all covered up afterwards. And it's very interesting that he found that back door in that Silverstream software, because I believe that you could just create a little computer code, which, like they had all these, when they were trying to unravel the accounting for the BCCI, you know how it just, they found that all these accounts just went around in circles. And you could write a computer program. I know I could write a computer program that would go into this backdoor thing and basically install a code that would move money around in different amounts through a circuitous routes that would always, it would be different every time, but eventually the money would filter off into certain accounts over time, but you'd never be able to trace it because it would be going back this way, that way, every which way. But eventually you just take pennies off or cents off every time, and it would filter out into certain accounts. You could do these sorts of things. So it got me thinking about, you know, what could have been going on inside the World Trade Center while these attacks were actually happening from the financial aspect. And I think some of the research that people have already done of this it's a gold mine for indictments and whatever we want to be getting in terms of the truth movement. Because at this point, it's like if we stick to the same old evidence we've been using, you know, this whole Building 7 campaign, what about Building 7? And I thought that was a really interesting approach. It's getting a lot of people aware of this, but I mean, 12 years later now, we're approaching, you know, the anniversary. And if you still don't know what Building 7 is, then, I mean, gosh, you're out of the loop. And I think if you don't know what Building 7 is by this point in the game, I doubt you'll really be much help to the movement. I don't know how effective this will actually be at recruiting new people. And actually, I mean, it might be. It's drawing a lot of new newcomers into our movements. I'm an admin on the Facebook page. I'm a moderator on the 9/11 Truth Facebook page, and we've gotten about 50 new newcomers every single day since that ad went up. And it's really interesting seeing the influx of new people. And some of those people are good researchers. But what I'm saying is we need to really step down and we can go in a whole another direction. People don't realize the evidence we have. And rather than just getting an endless debate over whether World Trade Center 7 came down from controlled demolition or from fires, I think we need to really look at, you know, the who's who and some of these other things that were going on behind the scenes. Anyways, back to...
Well, I just want to say I think you're exactly right about that. And let me just say that I agree with you. I think that it's important that we do try to bring new people in through WTC7 outreach and the like, but we have to have something substantial behind it once they get into this. And I think we have to expand the scope of this. But let's just stop for a moment and talk about some of the things that you've raised, because you've raised a number of important points, including the idea of the tenants in the World Trade Center, and specifically the ones on the floors that were actually hit tend to be some of the most interesting members of this,
absolutely,
including some of the meetings that were supposedly scheduled to take place that morning, with some of the key members of those meetings not being there for one reason or another. Let's talk about some of the actual tenants that were hit on that morning.
Well, back to Richard Grove's testimony, he said that he had brought up to his superiors when he was working there, and others at Marsh, that this back hole existed in the software, and they were selling this this basically useless security software to these Fortune 500 companies, and any one of them could be hacked through it. And he was trying to bring that up and raise suspicions about it, and they seemed uninterested at first. But then they called him up about 6 months later and asked him to come to a hearing on this and to bring all his evidence to a meeting, I think, on the 93rd floor of the World Trade Center. And he knew a couple other people who worked with him at Mars that knew different things about what maybe had been going on. And they were all told to be at those meetings as well. And I think that's very sinister in a lot of ways. Richard Grove, thankfully, was late and saw the towers smoking when he got there and was like, I probably shouldn't go to work today. And that was a good idea. But you just think of who else died in that tower, in those towers that day, and what they know and what went and disappeared with them that day. And I think that's another interesting thing. People don't realize. They say, what about where are all these 9/11 whistleblowers? And why aren't more people talking out about this? Well, if you look at all the people that were going to talk out, the masterminds got rid of them in the whole chaos of that day. There were several people on Flight 77 that I could get into names that they were connected with, actually Pentagon operations connected with remote control aircraft technologies, believe it or not, remote control guidance systems for airplanes. They basically were working on a Pentagon program that knew how to hijack and fly airplanes by remote control. And those people somehow wound up on that flight into the Pentagon that day. I thought that was really interesting. Another thing was AIG and Marsha McLennan. Marsha McLennan was actually... it was right in the impact zone where the planes hit on 9/11. And that's where that's where they were told to go to this meeting with this high level executive from Marsh, but they wouldn't name who it was. I kind of have come to the conclusion through logical deduction that it was either a guy named L. Paul Bremer or Jeffrey Greenberg. And, it's interesting. Jeffrey Greenberg is the son of Maurice Greenberg, who is the owner of AIG. AIG is a large insurance company, but also has a long-standing history with the CIA and also ties to, believe it or not, a lot of the systems that launder drug money for the banks. And I thought that was an interesting connection because AIG is sort of benefiting from this whole thing through a lot of their investments. And AIG was actually the parent company of Kroll Associates, which ran security at the World Trade Center itself. So, in my research a couple years ago, I came across a lot of this stuff about, the five dancing Israelis and the urban moving systems van, the van on the Washington Bridge with explosives, the guys from Urban Moving Systems and the Israeli art students that were staying in the World Trade Center. And I looked at those leads and was like, this could have been a Mossad operation. But at the same time, I thought, how the heck did any of those guys get explosives actually inside the buildings and rig those buildings up? I mean, yeah, these guys are around in the proximity and the perimeter, but how did they rig the towers? And in order to do that, you really needed security access to those buildings, electronic security, the whole cameras, all everything, the whole shebang. You needed full access to those buildings. And there's only a few companies that actually had that from my research, as far as I can tell. One of the most famous ones people talk about is Securecom Stratasec, which Marvin Bush sat on the board of directors for a period of years after the 93 World Trade Center bombing. And he left, I think, in June of 2000. So there's a lot of these companies sort of coming in and out of control over those buildings that I think should be further looked into by people in the movement. And some of their connections are also quite interesting. Marsh and AIG set up a secure trading platform, somehow this state-of-the-art secure trading network that would link Marsh and AIG somehow. State-of-the-art, no other companies in the world needed this to trade. But I thought that was an interesting computer connection, and it might have some relevance to whatever was going on with those computers inside the buildings that were targeted on 9/11 prior to the collapse. So I think there's a lot more Wall Street crime involved in 9/11 that a lot of people in the movement and researchers are out there realizing at this point. And that I think one person that did come close to that was a guy named Elliot Spitzer, who did a probe into AIG rather. And he was shortly around the time he was doing that probe into AIG, all of a sudden this erupted, this prostitution scandal, and kind of the whole thing went bye-bye. And I think there's maybe some alternative motives behind why that all went down, because you start digging into AIG and Wall Street, and it's going to get into 9/11, and there's some skeletons in that closet, believe it.
Oh, I certainly do, and I think you're exactly right. And you're right. There are so many different financial companies that are involved in this, and also, as you mentioned, the demolition access, the access to the towers for the purposes of setting up the demolition, is extremely right. important, and has been well researched by Kevin Ryan in some of his articles. Let's talk about some of the actual individuals involved in this. Let's talk, for example, about L. Paul Bremer.
Right. L. Paul Bremer is a very interesting guy. He was came from Harvard. He was on all these boards or terrorism boards, advisory boards that would advise the government on terrorism and counterterrorism. He'll correct you. He's corrected some people for telling him that you're an expert on terrorism. No, counterterrorism. Yeah, right. So anyways, L. Paul Bremer decided to miss work, and that he skipped out on that meeting that morning and apparently went on, thought it was more important to go on MSNBC. And give the world the first official pronouncement that Osama bin Laden was probably responsible, and probably Iraq and Iran, and that we should probably have the most severe military reaction possible or response possible. And I thought that was very interesting. He's kind of one of those guys that just prefers to stay in the shadows behind the scenes of a lot of these things. He ran the whole Iraq war. He doesn't really interact with the media or give public statements that often, but he's one of those players that, you know, it's like, I was always knew that some guys behind the scenes in this operation that are well connected and deep state operatives, and they're just these shadow people. And L. Paul Bremer is definitely one of them. I mean, he's chicken hawk coming out in support of the Syria war. He's just a military industrial complex pawn, and he probably has a long-standing relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency. He's a very, very smart guy. He watches interviews, and you do any research on this guy, you know that he's very witty and capable individual. I mean, he managed a company with over 10,000 employees, and he was a CEO. He's knows how to manage large scale operations and manage large numbers of people and get things done effectively. And I just I think he's the kind of guy who could have killed everyone in his that he worked with and then gone on news with a straight face and gave that interview that the way he did. He just disgusts me, really. Another guy is another guy. I mentioned a lot of names in those videos, and that those come from that all came from Kevin Ryan's paper on who had demolition access to the World Trade Center. There's a lot of interesting guys that just were sort of revolving around this World Trade Center complex. A lot of suspicious characters, and for example, that guy Joseph Caspudes, he worked for Baseline Financial, and he was actually in the impact zone of the South Tower that was hit. And Joseph Caspudes has he's a longtime proponent of the history with the military-industrial complex and also oil and banking. He's a crony from the Department of Energy, long time, and the DOE, of course. I mean, that gets into a whole another aspect of 9/11, which I think is important, because a lot of people say, oh, we didn't go in there for the oil, and they get that oil issue all wrong. And it's not about the oil. It's about controlling what currency oil is traded in on international markets. That's it. It's called petrodollar recycling. It has an extraordinary history. I invite anyone who wants to strengthen their arguments on that point to go and research the history behind it and sort of the people that and players around this. The first Bilderberg meeting ever was when they brought up the whole idea of petrodollar recycling. I thought that was quite interesting, that all these Bilderbergers, that when people want to talk about all this other stuff, but look what's central to their whole plan. It's petrodollars and this oil standard. And a lot of the people that are involved, like this guy Joseph Caspudes from the Department of Energy, and also even the Bush family with their connections through the Carlyle Group, and it's basically a large-scale investment firm that invests in the military industrial complex and benefits off the war on terror. This is a company that is a direct business connection between the Bush family and the bin Laden family. Guys from that, Frank Carlucci, he's an interesting guy from the Carlyle Group. He was meeting with Bush and bin Laden's brother on the morning of 9/11. He's a long history in a lot of black operations. And Frank Carlucci is just, he's one of these guys. He came from Iran-Contra. He was doing a lot of shady business deals with big business and intelligence work. They're basically in the business of taking over countries economically and financially and whatnot. And it's just, there's a whole bunch of these guys just crawling around behind the scenes, and people want to talk about Larry Silverstein and stuff. And or Bush, you know, Bush was just he's just an imbecile pawn front man that did only was there to look like an idiot so they could blame it all on incompetence after the fact. The real brains behind the operation was obviously Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. We can't forget about Donnie. And Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, they first got their – they rose to power in the Ford and Nixon administrations, and they spent the next 20 to 30 years basically working on continuity of government operations and sitting on think tanks which planned out doomsday scenarios and how they would sustain government in the event of any scenario you can imagine. Their job is to sit down and imagine events just like 9/11. And then figure out what the government would do. And they were experts on that. They knew exactly what the government would how the government would react. They sat on these think tanks that managed how these scenarios and these situations would work. So these guys sat there and trained for 20 years in the White House on these continuity of government operations, basically planning on how to take over the U.S. government in the event of a doomsday scenario. And then on 9/11 is the first time we know that had ever happened. I think it's just, I don't think it will be another 15 years before all these guys are in jail for war crimes. It really can't last this long with the internet and the way the information can just spread. The only thing we have working against us is, I think, human stupidity or distractions and stuff in the world now at this point. I mean, I can say this because I've been researching this almost nonstop for the past 8 years. It's become like a big part of my life. And I think in order for people to grasp 9/11 in the same way, they would have to invest so much time and energy. It's almost difficult to think that the population is capable of even waking up at this point. There's so much to know about who is really behind it and who's screwing you at the end of the day. I just don't think people would have the patience to really sit down and sort through it all, especially with all the disinformation and other stuff out there. It's really hard to get to these core facts. And that's what I've been stressing for the past, 8 years when I've been producing videos and engaging in this movement, is we have to focus on core evidence. That's core issues. All this other stuff that, you see popping up all the time, the missile with the Pentagon, that stuff, I guess, it's worth mentioning. It's not a good first four. It's not like you best evidence first. We have so much better evidence now after 12 years of intense research by some of the, most amazing people this world has ever seen in this movement, honestly, have revealed so much about what really happened and who was behind it, that it's really at this point, it's like we need to be focusing on indictments and bringing these people to justice, because it's really gotten to that point. We have enough evidence to indict them all on war crimes. And what jury wouldn't convict them with it, with all the circumstantial evidence, even with everything they destroyed by shipping off the crime scenes with Giuliani on 9/11. Giuliani's another key player. He's a good friend and pal from the Iran-Contra affair. He went and prosecuted BCCI as a New York State district attorney, and then I actually went and worked for a law firm afterward that represented BCI. So he went to work for the law firm that he was supposed to be prosecuting these people. So he's like, he's shifting sides on that. And I think that was his foot in the door of this underground corporate criminal network. And Giuliani demanded that the Office of Emergency Management be placed in Building 7 against all advice and against all everyone was telling him not to. And he demanded that the Office of Emergency Management be moved to that building. And I think there's a lot of other interesting connections and things in that building that we still haven't got to the bottom of. And we still we may never get to the bottom because a lot of the files were destroyed. SEC investigations into Walmart, Wall Street fraud, stock market fraud. An Enron scandal, and any number of things, even some speculation that was the World Trade Center 7 housed the offsite backup for the Pentagon's block budget operations. And maybe there was some issue with that $2.3 trillion that went missing in the financial accounting wing of the Pentagon that was struck on 9/11, and maybe some correlation between other files that went down in World Trade Center 7. It's just at this point in the game, it's really useless to argue over points where, just the same stuff that we've been seeing for the past 8 years, controlled demolition. Yeah, I'm, I, you can sit there and argue it all day, but if you don't put suspects in people's faces and show them, these are the guys, all right, these guys all worked in the inside of these buildings. They all benefited, made millions of dollars off their investments in the war on terror since. L. Paul Bremer skipped work that day, went on to be the Iraq occupation governor and basically led the whole Iraq invasion. Just all the other evidence we have, it's just at this point in the game, I really think we need to move toward, and people need to start focusing on this stuff. And I mean, I became aware of this stuff probably about a year or two ago when I began researching it and getting into Kevin Ryan's work. And I said, you know, this is so long and detailed. Nobody's ever going to take the time to read this. So that's why I went and put that video together so I could take all that really hard to digest information and put it in a way that people could just sit down and press play and it would get to them. They wouldn't have to do all the digging and all the facts and source checking that I do to put these things together and stuff, even though I encourage everyone to do that with everything that you come across, no matter what it is. Even stuff I say, or even stuff I've put out, you know, I have made mistakes in my videos and I'm not above that by any means, but I think we have more than enough, evidence and information put forward that even if a small fraction of this is true, then, you know, something
pretty significant. Well, let's talk about someone else who's related to Bremer, ended up in Iraq with Bremer, was also related to Giuliani on the scene in New York. I'm talking about Bernard Carrick of the NYPD there. A very yes. interesting character who had an interesting part to play on 9/11. And then as I say, ended up in Iraq with Bremer. Let's talk a little bit about him.
Right. He came from the New York City police chief. I believe he's good old buddy of Giuliani's, and him and Giuliani go back. I believe he's got a lot of connections to. Well, I don't believe it's a proven fact. Heck, there's a documented court case. He just got out of jail. Federal prison, not jail, is a big difference. He just got out of federal prison a few months ago for corruption and conspiracy charges, unrelated to 9/11, but it's related to some of the other business dealings and associates he had while he was New York City police commissioner, and. You know, New York, I don't know anyone who's ever been there. I just feel it's one of the most corrupt places on the planet. I just feel I feel like corruption oozes from that place. I've driven by it. I've been there. I just can't imagine that the New York City police commissioner would not have some sort of interesting mafia connections or something. Also, Bernard Carrick's department was the ones that found that passport that allegedly came from Saddam al-Sakwami's passport pocket. That he flew the plane through the building with the passport in his pocket, and that it flew through this building and wound up on the street in completely pristine condition, not even singed or burnt or dented or scratched, and yet they couldn't find the Titanic in black boxes. But I thought that was interesting that that passport was found by Carrick's department, and that's an interesting fact because if you are to believe, as any fool would probably draw that conclusion that was in fact planted or manufactured evidence. There's no way a passport can go through an entire steel building in a fireball and still be in that condition. Then it's the next logical question is, well, who could have been responsible for placing that there? And it's interesting, the other place Carrick appeared at, he appeared a lot in the action of all the footage from Giuliani and Giuliani's movements on the day of 9/11. Carrick seemed to be following him around the entire day, coaching a lot of his movements. And it seemed like he knew more than what Giuliani knew, or I don't know which of them knew more or what they knew, if anything. But they both seemed to be acting very suspicious that day. Carrick is, of course, credited with giving the first official government pronouncement that no explosives were used. All the news stations at the first press conference, the only question on people's minds were explosives used? What happened to these towers? How were they blown up? And his response was no, nothing like that of the sort. And so he gave us the official announcement that no explosives were used. Then, of course, he was actually he was nominated, I believe, to be director of Homeland Security. Believe it or not, he turned down that. I think he realized it would be kind of obvious and stupid for him to even consider taking that after the kind of the heat that would be on him and on the attention that it would draw to himself. So he decided, yeah, I'll just go and tag along with Bremer in Iraq and help train the Iraqi police force. And that's sort of where he was until of course, we all know he went to federal prison for 4 years back in, it was actually only 3 years, because it was back in 2010. So, and he just got out in March. But it's interesting. Just kind of goes to show you another aspect that they have the New York City governor in their pocket, the New York City police chief in their pocket. I mean, those are two key guys to have as co-conspirators if you're going to pull off an operation like this, and two necessary figures in order to ensure it all goes down properly and nobody asks any questions, or at least not the right questions. So I thought that that was very interesting. It seems like they covered their tracks very well as far as making sure the FBI, actually the entire FBI counterterrorism task force, was flown out to Monterey, California for a company retreat. So they got all the FBI out of the area so that they could ensure that whoever they wanted to put in charge would be placed in charge. And so when those other guys got back, they say, oh, someone else has already got it under control. We got it all covered. And it's sort of interesting that they had this managed. They thought this thing through from the cover up to the end. And Giuliani, as a former U.S. prosecutor, violated criminal law and destroyed all the evidence from the crime scene or as much of it as he could in a timely fashion. And they had a lot of also interestingly, they had a lot of these other devices, robotic devices that were brought in that were made for searching for and exploding undetonated ordnance and things like that. That was very interesting. I don't know what kind of people were crawling through that pile, but they had a lot of people cleaning up some stuff and getting rid of a lot of evidence right away. Probably right up after the towers fell. It's interesting. Every single aspect that I've investigated of this, it's just comes full circle to really show you a picture of 9/11 that's nothing like what we were told. And I think that, you know, I'm going to try everything that I can do to wake people up to this and get the facts out and get this information out as best as I can, and to not only do that on the street, but also on the internet. So,
well, as you say, I mean, not only did they cover their tracks in terms of the physical evidence, but in terms of any angle for a future investigation. And as you say, the New York Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, to the extent that he was interested in looking into some of the crimes of these companies, was quickly taken out of the picture. So it really does create the real problem of how can we proceed with this, given the characters that are involved and the extent of the cover-up. And it really does make you wonder if there will ever be that type of JFK moment where someone like Jim Garrison steps forward to start an actual case, a legal proceeding, to try to indict right. Some of these people. I mean, I think that's what we have to be working at as researchers, is trying to lay this information out to form the basis for indictments of some of these people. But it is right. Up to some DA or someone out there to actually step up to the plate and start the
investigation. I certainly can't. You and me certainly can't do it. We need some serious help. Or even if, you know, another Oliver Stone were to come along and make a movie about this. And I've put that offer on the table. If you want a script, I got one. And let's talk. I got one that no one's ever seen. And we'll put it into a movie and put out everything, all the stuff that I didn't even have enough time to include, like the put options, even more stuff. Nothing that isn't already out there on the internet. But you know, I'm not trying to get myself killed saying I have secret information about 9/11 that I haven't revealed yet. But I have another script written that I could make into a full. It's meant for a full length feature film, but I need a production team to help me make it. I mean, it took me months to put that other film together, and even then, it's not very you can tell it's amateur work. But at the same time, it's not about the production quality; it's the information that it contains. So, I really want to try and get someone along to catapult this out, because you know we have all this attention being brought, but there's harder evidence. And I think it's great that people have reposted my 9/11 conspiracy solved video. I saw one repost by Nuovisio. It's got 413,000 views last time I checked. That's awesome. Almost to 500,000. And you know, the more people that we can make aware of these inside explosive connections, the closer we're going to be toward convincing someone like Jim Garrison to be like, hey, there's a case here. You know, we could pursue this. But I don't know. It might take the efforts of a world court and a world government, which is I don't know. That's something I'm afraid of as well, because I wouldn't want them to set up a world court to prosecute anyone. I don't want a world court.
That's it. And also, the other part of this is that Garrison ultimately was unsuccessful because his investigation was undermined from start to finish by the CIA and infiltrated by the FBI and others, and was completely 100% derailed. And a lot of his witnesses went missing and dead in the course of his investigation. So it's something that is not going to present itself as an easy case to prosecute in any respect. But at any rate, I think it's what we have to be working towards. Unfortunately, we're out of time for today's conversation, so we're going to have to leave things there. But I will 100% wholeheartedly direct people to your video, which, again, I will be posting in the show notes for this interview, 9/11 Conspiracy Solved, and also to WarCrime 911 as a YouTube channel in general for all sorts of information on these subjects. So, Jeremy Rees, I think we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you again for your time today. Right. I really do appreciate it.
Awesome. I'll send you some links to post as well. And let's go after these guys, man.
Let's get them. All right. Thank you.
Let's get them.